And I'm back to read Hitler's War by David Irving. Incidents is the chapter. By November 1939, Adolf Hitler had faced up to the fact that the war would go on. When Alfred Rosenberg came to him with nebulous reports of fresh peace moves within the British Air Ministry, the Führer belittled the prospects. While he himself would still favor a German-British rapprochement, he said, London was in the grip of a Jewish-controlled lunatic minority. Hitler said he failed to see what the British really wanted. Even if British won, this is Hitler speaking, the real victors would be the United States, Japan, and Russia. German propaganda now portrayed the British, whom Hitler had unsuccessfully wooed, as murderers, liars, and hypocrites. That Britain was continuing the fight was an unpalatable truth Hitler could no longer ignore. Upon his return from Poland, Hitler had equipped the big Congress room in his official Berlin residence as a war conference room. In its center was a large map table. The OKW, Wehrmacht High Command, Generals Keitel and Jodl moved into neighboring rooms vacated by Hitler's adjutants. Jodl's status was still relatively weak. When he ventured an appreciation of the overall strategic situation, Hitler cut him short after the first few sentences. But Hitler's regard for Jodl grew as his contempt for the army's representatives became more explicit. He told Jodl in the middle of October, "We're going to win this war, even if it contradicts 100 general staff doctrines, because we've got the better troops, the better equipment, the stronger nerves, and a united, resolute leadership." On October 19th, the reluctant War Department had, at Hitler's behest, issued its first hasty directive on Yellow. It envisaged a massive main attack being carried through Belgium by 75 divisions. Army Group C, commanded by General von Lieb, would remain on the defensive with 16 divisions behind the West Wall. Meanwhile, to justify invading neutral Belgium, the intelligence agencies were instructed to compile detailed summaries of instances of Franco-Belgian collusion and to allow their imaginations free rein in doing so. The military prospects of this OKH plan did not encourage Bock and Rundstedt, who expressed their pessimism in memoranda to the War Department in October. Lieb added a similar study questioning the propriety of violating Belgian and Dutch neutrality. When Hitler voiced his own fear that if Yellow was not executed forthwith, one fine winter's night, Britain and France may arrive at the Meuse without a shot being fired, General von Reichenau stubbornly retorted, "That would be preferable in my view." When Keitel returned from Zossen, Hitler bitterly accused his OKW chief of conspiring with the generals against him. He insisted that in the future, Keitel loyally transmit the Führer's will to the War Department. The army put the strength of the French army far too high in Hitler's view. What perturbed him was the growing British force in France, for he considered each British division was worth three or four French. Other generals pointed out that the winter nights were long and that the combination of long nights and rainy, foggy days would make a war of movement difficult. But Hitler wanted a war in which his armored and mechanized formations could sweep forward, exploiting the inflexibility of the French and the inertia of the British armies. The more he pored over the maps, the less he liked the War Department's proposed operational plan. In the third week of October, he commented acidly to Keitel and Jodl that Halder's plan, with its strong right wing along the coast, was no different than the Schlieffen plan drafted before World War I. "You cannot get away with an operation like that twice. I have something very different in mind. I will tell you two about it in the next few days." This was the alternative possibility, a vast encirclement of the enemy, spearheaded by the armored units thrusting eventually up to the coast between the Meuse River and Arras and Amiens. Farther to the north, in Flanders, the tanks would get into terrain difficulties. The idea obsessed him, and at the end of a discussion with the senior Yellow generals at Reich Chancellery on October 25th, he put it to the commander-in-chief. Bock, who was also present, wrote in his diary that the Führer, said in reply to a question from Braukitsch that from the very outset he has had the following wish and idea: to deliver the main offensive only south of Musa, so that by our advancing in a roughly westerly and then northwesterly direction, the enemy forces already in or pouring in to Belgium will be cut off and destroyed. Braukitsch and Halder are obviously taken completely by surprise, and a lively debate rages to and fro over this idea. This was the germ of the campaign plan that was to bring about France's defeat. It staked everything on one card, namely that the German armies would succeed in breaking through to the Channel coast. But he asked the army to look into his idea, and from a snide remark it was clear that he was not averse to postponing Yellow until spring if need be. If Hitler invaded Belgium, then Albert Canal and the nearby fortress of Ibn Emael would represent serious obstacles to the advance of Reichenau's Sixth Army. The canal had been designed from the outset as a moat, an integral part of the Belgian eastern defenses, and it was fortified with bunkers, blockhouses, and walls ramped to steep slopes. Only three bridges crossed the canal, and these had been built with pillboxes and demolition chambers. The Ibn Emael fortress had 18 heavy guns placed in casemates and armored turrets and manned by 1,000 Belgian troops living underground in the tunnels and bunkers. Since the whole system was some 20 miles from the Reich frontier, the bridges could be demolished long before German army advance parties could reach them. The Germans would then have to cross the wide Musa by two available bridges on the Dutch side at Maastricht, and these had also been prepared for demolition. This complex problem occupied Hitler as much as the rest of Yellow's problems put together. In the last week of October, he proposed setting up a camouflaged Abwehr battalion under Reichenau's control. Commanded by a Lieutenant Hacke, this battalion would be rigged out in uniforms used by the Dutch frontier police in the Maastricht enclave. As Hitler was to say, "In wartime, a uniform is always the best camouflage. But one thing is vital, that the leaders of Hacke's shock troops be the spitting image of Dutch police officers as far as language, dress, and behavior go." Their job would be to put the detonating cables and charges out of action. Hitler lamented his army general's inability to come up with ideas like these. "These generals are too prim and proper," he scoffed after one such conference. "They ought to have read more Karl May." There's a asterisk here regarding Karl May. German author of popular and ingenious American Indian stories. So it's probably some clever stuff in there. I've never read any. He had a solution for the fortress of Ibn Emael as well. Some 300 airborne troops would land within the fortress walls in the darkness before dawn. They were to be equipped with deadly 50-kilo hollow-charge explosives capable of knocking out the big guns there. At the beginning of November, the 7th Air Division ordered the immediate evacuation of an airborne assault unit for the glider operation. The unit was to be ready for action by the 12th, the provisional D-Day. There was much that could and did go wrong. An official of the Munster Abwehr Office was detected purchasing large quantities of Dutch police uniforms in the province of Groningen. For several days, Dutch newspapers featured cartoons speculating on the manner in which the Nazi invaders would be dressed when they came. One cartoon showed Goering skulking in the uniform of a Dutch streetcar conductor. With the attack ostensibly just 1 week away, the German army command was in a high state of nervousness. At noon, on November 5th, General von Braukitsch himself secured an audience with the Führer, having himself written out in longhand an answer to Hitler's memorandum of October 9th. His main concern was the state of the army in the west. In the Polish campaign, the infantry had shown little verve in attack. Braukitsch even spoke of mutinies in some units, and he recounted acts of drunken indiscipline at the front and on the railways during the transfer west. On hearing this, Hitler lost his temper and demanded the identities of the units involved. Snatching Brockish's memorandum from his hands, he thundered at the general. Not one frontline commander mentioned any lack of attacking spirit to me, but now I have to listen to this after the army has achieved a magnificent victory in Poland. He insisted that Brockish furnish him with the reports he had mentioned. Sweeping out of the room, Hitler slammed the door behind him and left Brockish trembling. To Fräulein Schroeder, he dictated an aide memoir on the ugly scene. He also dictated a document dismissing Brockich, but Keitel talked him out of this. There was no suitable successor for the courtly and pliable commander-in-chief of the German army. 2 days later, Hitler provisionally postponed Yellow by 3 days, giving the weather as the reason. That evening, November 7th, 1939, his special train left for Munich. He had to speak to the old guard at Bürgerbräukeller. Fuck. This Bürgerbräu assembly and the long march through Munich's narrow streets were annual opportunities to an assassin. On November 9, 1938, a Swiss waiter named Maurice Bavaud, a nephew of Helmar Schacht, as it turned out, had trained a gun on him during this very march through Munich. Hitler learned of the attempt only when Bavaud was stopped by railway police at Augsburg, as he was attempting to leave Germany, for not having a valid ticket. He confessed to having also stalked Hitler with a gun during his daily walks on the Obersalzberg mountain in October. Bavaud was due to come up for secret trial by the People's Court on December 1st, 1939. There's another asterisk here. He was beheaded. That's all it says. Hitler was supposed to remain in Munich until the 9th. However, on the morning of the 8th, his residence was telephoned from Berlin that the army was demanding a fresh decision on the deadline for Yellow in view of the weather, and he sent an adjutant to arrange for his private coaches to be attached to the regular express train that same evening. His adjutant returned with word that it would be cutting things fine if he was to catch this train after his speech. Hitler, therefore, brought forward the beginning of his speech by 5 minutes to 8:10 p.m., and ordered Hess to stand in for him during ceremonies scheduled for the next day. At 8 o'clock sharp, the Führer entered the cavernous beer hall. The band stopped playing, and Christian Weber, one of the party's leading figures in Bavaria, spoke a few brief words of welcome. Hitler stood at a lectern in front of one of the big wood-paneled pillars. His speech was a tirade against Britain, whose true motives for this new crusade he identified as jealousy and hatred of the new Germany. Which had achieved in 6 years more than Britain had in centuries. Julius Schaub nervously passed him cards on which he had scrawled increasingly urgent admonitions. 10 minutes, then five, and finally a peremptory, "Stop! Party members, comrades of our National Socialist Movement, our German people, and above all, our victorious Wehrmacht, Sieg Heil!" Hitler concluded and stepped into the midst of the party officials who thronged forward. A harassed Julius Schaub managed to shepherd the Führer out of the hall at 9:12. At the Augsburg station, the first stop after Munich, confused word was passed to Hitler's coach that something had occurred at the Bürgerbräu at the Nuremberg station. The police chief, Dr. Martin, was waiting with more detailed news. Just 8 minutes after Hitler had left the beer hall, a powerful bomb had exploded in the paneled pillar right behind where he had been speaking. There were many dead and injured. Hitler's Luftwaffe aide, Colonel Nicholas von Bello, later wrote, "The news made a vivid impression on Hitler. He fell very silent, and then described it as a miracle that the bomb had missed him." There's another asterisk here. Bello's account goes on to say that Hitler often excitedly repeated the circumstances that had led to his leaving the Bürgerbräu early, see also Rosenberg's diary, November 11th. He joked that it was time the weather expert had, that this time the weather expert had saved his life. Otherwise, commented the Führer, the expert was pushing him into an early grave with his weather forecasts, for the weather outlook was black and likely to continue so. Back up. Where was that? Okay. For several days afterward, his adjutants Bruckner and Wunsche brought to the ruffled Führer telegrams of congratulation from people like Admiral von Horthy, the King and Queen of Italy, Benito Mussolini, and the still-exiled Kaiser Wilhelm, and Field Marshal von Blomberg. Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands cabled, Herr Reich Chancellor, may I send to you my most heartfelt congratulations on your escape from the abominable attempt on your life. Even as Hitler had been speaking at the Bürgerbräu, a man had been apprehended at Konstanz. George Elser, a 36-year-old Swabian watchmaker, confessed that he had single-handedly designed, built, and installed a time bomb in the pillar. Under Gestapo interrogation a week later, the whole story came out, how he had joined the Red Front 10 years before, but had lost interest in politics, and how he had been angered by the regimentation of labor and religion. The year before, he had resolved to dispose of Adolf Hitler and had begun work on a time bomb controlled by two clock mechanisms. After 30 nights of arduous chiseling at the pillar behind the paneling, he had installed the preset clocks, soundproofed in cork to prevent the ticking from being heard. Elster's simple pride in his craftsmanship was evident from the records of his interrogations. He probably was telling the truth, and there was no doubt that one watchmaker acting alone had nearly accomplished what, after years of debate, planning, and self-indulgent conspiracy, a battalion of officers and intellectuals were to fail to do 5 years later. In private, Hitler assured his staff that one day he would publish the whole story, but not yet, as he also wanted to round up those who had pulled the strings. General Rommel wrote on November 9th, "My only hope is that now in the Führer's headquarters, too, the security precautions will be better organized with everything in one person's hands, (parentheses, mine). Because if anybody is going to take this responsibility, he cannot share it with anybody else." And on the 15th, referring to Operation Yellow, Rommel wrote, "The assassination attempt in Munich has only made the Führer's resolution stronger. It is a marvel to witness all this." On the day after the Munich explosion, Hitler again postponed Yellow. On November 13th, he further instructed that the offensive would not begin before the 22nd. There is some reason to believe that Hitler himself did not intend these deadlines to be serious, that they were designed to keep the army at maximum readiness in case the Western powers should themselves suddenly invade the Low Countries. Hitler did not doubt that the West had economic means enough to pressure the Low Countries into appealing for help at a propitious moment. "Let us not credit the enemy with a lack of logic," Hitler said later in November. "If we respect their, the Low Countries, neutrality, the Western powers will just march in during the spring." Hitler was also under pressure from Goering and the Luftwaffe's chief of staff, Hans Jeschenik, to occupy the whole of Holland. Possession of Holland would be vital for the future air war between Britain and Germany. So the time had come to compromise the Dutch. German army officers, supplied by Heydrich, appeared on the 9th at Venlo, just inside the Dutch frontier. British agents drove up for a prearranged meeting with them. There was a rapid exchange of gunfire, and they were dragged across the border into Germany, together with the driver and another officer mortally wounded. This latter turned out to be a Dutch intelligence officer accompanying them. Hitler said this was proof that the ostensibly neutral Dutch were working hand in glove with the British. "When the time comes, I shall use all this to justify my attack," he told his generals. "The violation of Belgian and Dutch neutrality is unimportant. Nobody asks about such things after we have won." On November 13th, General Jodl instructed the War Department that a new Führer directive was on its way. "The army must be prepared to occupy as much of Holland as possible to improve Germany's air defense position." On November 20th, Hitler issued a directive which finally ranked the attack in Holland equal to those on Belgium and France. In variation of the earlier directive, all measures planned against Holland are authorized to commence simultaneously with the beginning of the general offensive, without special orders to that effect. Where no opposition is encountered, the invasion is to be given the character of a peaceful occupation. In the East, meanwhile, the devil's work was well in hand. Gruesome reports of massacres began to filter up through army channels. Consciences had to be salved, and the reports were dutifully shuttled about between the adjutants. Thus, soon after the Munich plot, Captain Engel received from Brauchitsch's adjutant a grisly set of eyewitness accounts of executions by the SS at Schwetz. An outspoken medical officer addressed to Hitler in person a report summarizing the eyewitness evidence of three of his men. Together with about 150 fellow soldiers, they witnessed the summary execution of about 20 or 30 Poles at the Jewish cemetery at Schwetz at about 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, October 8th. The execution was carried out by a detachment consisting of an SS man, two men in old blue police uniforms, and a man in plain clothes. An SS major was in command. Among those executed were also five or six children aged from 2 to 8 years old. Whether Engel showed his document and its attached eyewitness accounts to Hitler is uncertain. He returned it to Brauchitsch's adjutant almost immediately with a note, "The appropriate action to be taken at this end will be discussed orally." In the Reich Chancellery, the large table in the old cabinet room was now dominated by a relief map of the Ardennes, the mountainous, difficult region of Belgium and Luxembourg that was twice to be the scene of Hitler's unorthodox military strategy. Many an hour he stood alone in the evenings, tracing the narrow mountain roads and asking himself whether his tanks and mechanized divisions would be able to get through them. By now he had been provided with the original construction plans of the bridges across the Albert Canal. Previously, he had only aerial photographs and picture postcards of these important targets. From other sources, he had similar details on the fortress at Ibn Emael. A scale model of the fortress had been built, and intensive training of the glider crews had begun under top security conditions. The bridges presented the most intractable problem, the more so since the Dutch had evidently been warned by anti-Nazi agents in Berlin on November 12th. Extensive security precautions had been suddenly introduced at the Maastricht bridges. And asterisk time. Scroll down. Colonel Hans Oster, Canaris's chief of staff in the Abwehr, had himself warned the Belgian and Dutch legations that Hitler planned to attack on November 12th. The fake uniform scheme was not mentioned. Oster had been cashiered from the Reichswehr over a morals scandal in 1934 and immediately conscripted into the Abwehr by Canaris. Both men were hanged as traitors in April 1945. Back up. Hitler discussed the operations with Canaris and Colonel Erwin Lehosen on November 16th. He did not believe they would capture the bridges over the Albert Canal by surprise alone, and he began casting around for other means of preventing the bridge's destruction. He ordered a full-scale secret conference on the bridge's plan on November 20th. General von Reichenau made it clear that the invasion of Holland had already been compromised once. He had no faith in the Abwehr's Trojan horse plan, since the Dutch authorities were now expecting police uniforms to be used, as was shown by the fact that they were issued special armbands to their police. There was little prospect of the Abwehr getting away with it. Hitler replied, "Then the entire operation, as at present planned, is pointless." Canaris did what he could to salvage the plan. Hitler was unconvinced. "None of the plans is bound to succeed. But after all, the other possibilities had been scrutinized, including attacking the bridges with light bombs to destroy the demolition cables, and rushing them with tanks and 88mm guns." There's another note towards the bottom here. "If it can't be accomplished by trickery," Hitler said, "then brute force must do." 88mm guns. He had to fall back on the Trojan horse. "There must be some means of getting these bridges into our hands," he complained. "We have managed to solve even bigger problems before." When the conference ended 4 hours later, Hitler had provisionally adopted the sequence proposed by Goering. At X hour proper, 15 minutes before dawn, the gliders would land silently on the fortress at Ibn Emael and the bridge at Caen. 5 minutes later, dive bombers would attack the other Albert Canal bridges to disrupt the demolition charges. The bombers would be followed 5 minutes later by the arrival of more glider-borne troops just east of the bridges themselves. At the same time, the Abwehr's disguised advance party would seize the Maastricht bridges. For this, they would have to cross the frontier in Dutch uniforms 45 minutes before X hour. The weather was still against yellow. Every morning, Berlin was in the grip of icy frost and fog, which lifted in the afternoons to let a weak sun filter through. On November 21st, the Führer issued orders for his leading generals and admirals to hear an exposure of his views 2 days later. To the large audience that packed the Great Hall of the Chancellery, Hitler depicted the coming battle as the operation that would finally bring down the curtain on the world war that Germany had been fighting ever since 1914. He recited the many occasions when, aided only by Providence, he had ignored the grim prophecies of others to exploit the brief opportunities that opened to him. He, Adolf Hitler, had now provided the generals with a strategic situation unparalleled since 1871. For the first time in history, we have only to fight on one front. The other is at present open. His own indispensability had been forcefully impressed on him by the recent assassination attempt. That there would be other attempts was probable. Thus, there was no time to be lost. The defensive strategy his cowardly army generals were calling for was short-sighted. Moltke had clearly shown that only through offensives could wars be decided. Germany's present enemies were weak and unready. Here, he illustrated his point by listing in turn the number of French tanks and guns and British ships. His speech bristled with concealed barbs against the army generals. Rommel wrote the next day, "But that seems quite necessary, too, because the more I speak with my comrades, the fewer I find with their heart and conviction in what they are doing. It is all very depressing." While Hitler praised the aggressive spirit of the Navy and Luftwaffe, he sneered, "If our commanders-in-chief are going to have nervous breakdowns as in 1914, what can we ask of our simple riflemen?" He had been deeply wounded by suggestions that the officers had to precede their men into battle. With consequently disproportionately high officer losses, that is what the officers are there for. He recalled how in 1914, after months of training, the infantry attack on Liège had broken up in panic and disaster. "I will not hear of complaints that the army is not in shape. Give the German soldier proper leadership, and I can do anything with him." It was not as though Germany had a real choice between armistice and war. "People will accuse me, war and yet more war, but I regard fighting as the fate of all the species. Nobody can opt out of the struggle, unless he wants to succumb." He's a true philosopher. A few minutes later, he said, "Victory or defeat, and it is not a matter of the future of National Socialist Germany, but of who will dominate Europe in the years to come. For this is worth making a supreme effort." He believed the present favorable strategic situation would last perhaps six more months, but then the British troops, a tenacious enemy, would vastly strengthen their foothold in France, and yellow would be a different proposition altogether. The speech lasted 2 hours. General von Brauchitsch reappeared in the evening and stiffly informed the Führer that if he had no confidence in him, he ought to replace him. Hitler retorted that the general must do his duty like every other soldier. He was not oblivious to the spirit of Sachsen prevailing in the army, and he would stamp it out. Sachsen was the headquarters of the general staff and seat of the conservative and conspiratorial elements of the German army. I believe that is the end of that chapter. Yep. So, finish that up. I'll upload it and maybe get started on the next one.